Okay, we were supposed to have music there, but that didn't seem to happen. So I'm going to just wing it and see how we go. Welcome to Rated LGBT Radio. Brent, are you there?
I am.
It's good to have you on.
Thanks, glad to be here.
Are you talking away from a microphone?
I'm on a headset.
Oh, okay, because I can barely hear you, I'm afraid.
Does that help? I'm going to try to turn it
that
up. That
does help. That helps enough. So, with full disclosure, everybody who's listening, I have invited Brent, and I don't know if we've confirmed this, but hopefully I'm going to have you on the Out in Santa Cruz show on Christmas Eve, that Saturday night, to talk about a really special article that you did and a reminiscent over the year of special notes that you put in your son's lunchbox, which is a specialty for you. But tonight I wanted to go kind of over more holistically your whole writing and blogging career, and you're well renowned as a daddy blogger. How did you get started with daddy blogging?
How's the volume right now? Is it okay?
Yeah, it could be up higher, but you know, I can still hear you.
Okay. I started officially on my son's first birthday, and I think I had been following some blogs in that first year and leading up to adopting our son, and was kind of started getting interested in the whole process, but was thinking I would go more of a graphic design direction because that's what I did for a living. But as I got closer to becoming a dad, I was like, oh, well, maybe I'll review baby products or something like that. But then once I actually became a dad, I'm like, I don't have time to do that, to go shopping and reviewing all these things. So it just became a more personal thing for me. And it's always been, I always mix in design-related things or pop culture, basically anything that interests me and has, a fun visual aesthetic. That's always going to be, that's a part of how I design, and it's part of, just a lot of things that I enjoy, entertainment and everything like that, and the kind of things that I pass on to my son. Luckily, that jives well with a lot of kids' products and movies and toys. So I'm getting to relive my childhood with my son and through the blog and everything. So
very cool. You didn't just kind of do a blog, though. I mean, you have taken it full force and been a force in behind a dad bloggers group. And can you give a little background on the dad bloggers group and where, well, let's start there. You know, what was the background on that group and your involvement?
Well, I guess before I had joined the dad bloggers group, a blogger named Oren Miller reached out to me because he and I live in the same area. But he would periodically, and he was really well known in the dad blogging community, but he would periodically just feature different dad bloggers on his blog, which is bloggerfather.com. And he featured me once, and I was like, wow, that's amazing, because I had just started out, and he said some really nice things. And then he started the dad bloggers Facebook group as a way for any dad blogger that wanted to have a voice and to network and to learn. And, you know, and I think I was number the sixth person to join that group, if you like scroll back. But Oren, contracted lung cancer a couple years ago. And that was an amazing, horrendous thing. But, by that point, I think we had about 900, 1,000 guys in the group. And everybody rallied behind him and ended up raising a bunch of money to help him and his family out. And then he passed away gosh, okay, so it's February of 2015.
Right.
And I was one of the admins at that point. But because I lived closest to him, I kind of became the go-between between him and the rest of the group, and was visiting him and his family, became really good friends with his family. And he asked me to speak at his funeral. It was, yeah. And then, but that's how I got heavily involved in the Dad Bloggers group specifically, which has just been a great resource for me and for thousands of other dads. Not just about blogging, but about fatherhood. I mean, a lot of really, like, you know, Orin's cancer is something that really bonded us all together. But it's, you know, every once in a while, there's something else that comes up too. Somebody loses a job, or somebody else gets sick, or getting divorced, or whatever it is. It's a pretty amazing group.
Right. Yeah. And I'm also part of that group.
Right.
I was way, way down for number six, but I don't remember what number it was when I joined it. What, and I'm glad you brought up Orin, because I think he is an important figure not to forget. But also he set some standards, I think, for the values of that group, but also I think dad blogging in general. Can you speak a little bit to what his legacy is about?
Yeah, well, the reason that he, you know, I just go back to the reason that he started the group, was because he had seen a picture at at some event with a bunch of the top dad bloggers. They'd gotten to go to some NFL football field and meet the players and do some kind of thing. And he thought, well, why does it have to be the top dad bloggers to get this kind of thing? And why are they the ones that get heard the most? And he was a very justice motivated and fair-minded person, and really did this so that everyone could, you know, have a level playing field, that the newbies can learn from the seasoned professionals, and that we could all kind of help each other out. But yeah, and he, you know, he was also very, he wanted to give people a chance to speak, to say what they believe, and that was his main motivation. And his legacy, I think, is just lots of great writing and men and dads expressing themselves and talking about being involved fathers. He was a stay-at-home dad, and kind of shifting the perception of what fatherhood is in the United States.
Right, absolutely. You and I had talked and when we were exchanging about coming on the radio, and you had sort of said that you were hitting kind of a malaise, probably because of the political climate, but it was finding something that you felt like getting out there and saying. And I also shared that I've been going through the same thing the past few months. Are you seeing that a lot in the whole dad blogging community?
Well, it's hard to say. I think when I've had a lot of things going on personally this year, and I've kind of been a little out of touch with at least what more people are doing. I mean, I stay connected with the people I'm closest to, but I do think that just from the conversations I've had and the things I've seen, that there's a lot of people expressing anger and confusion, and I think a lot more, there's just a lot more conversations going on via social media, as opposed to lots of people just churning out blog posts about it, because it's such an immediate thing. Like, there's some new thing every day, some new person appointed to cabinet, or, you know, some new thing to worry about. And it seems like it's constantly changing. That's part of the reason I find a hard time getting much down, written down. But I think it's also because, you know, I usually try to mix things up, like have something short or personal and light, or like a craft or pop culture or whatever, and then mix in the other things that are longer, more personal, or an opinion piece or something like that. But there's just so much going on in my head and so much going on in the world, it's hard to kind of put my finger on it. And then, I know for me personally, I went through about 8 years of conversion therapy, as they call it, in college and after college.
Wow.
And so when Pence was picked as VP, that kind of brought that up again for me. And there was something that happened again recently. There's an article on BuzzFeed about these, this couple that does a show, on
it's on the
HGTV.
HGTV, yeah.
Yeah,
and their minister that they go to is I guess profoundly anti-gay.
Right. Well, he was my minister.
Oh my gosh! Oh yeah. Wow. Okay.
And so there was a couple weeks there that I was kind of like I felt a real urgency to write something, but it really. I had never experienced a trigger before. I knew about them. I knew that certain things would set off things in people. But that was the first time I'd experienced something like that profoundly, just seeing this minister's face and hearing his voice and seeing him saying the same things that he said, you know, when he was my college pastor and my mentor. So I'll definitely write about it eventually, but I had to go through a process of like, okay, I didn't feel steady enough to like jump into the fray and call him out on, you know, on BuzzFeed or HuffPost or whatever, or Commun Project.
Right.
And just had to kind of let it lie for a little bit. But that was a big thing for me that I haven't been able to put out there, but it'll get there eventually.
Yeah, no, that's intense. What just going on that subject alone, with him, the one of the questions is because they don't, this couple doesn't present any of that in their TV show or seem to advocate for anything anti-gay. You having been around their minister, is it possible to attend that church and siphon that out or to be oblivious to that? Or is it something where they have to have absorbed it, but they're just simply not taking it forward in your opinion?
Well, right. Yeah. I mean, in my opinion, I mean, I did a little research on it and I actually have looking at three different drafts on my desktop. Just to get it out there. But, you know, I watched an interview that this pastor did. His name is Jimmy Seibert, that he did with the Gaineses on stage at the church. And knowing him like I have known him, I can't imagine he would give such a big platform and such a lot of airtime to someone that didn't toe the line on
right.
the, you know, on the hot, on the important subjects. And the truth is, I mean, the wife, she's gone to that church since high school. Like she was in high school when I was in college. So I just can't imagine being there that long and being that high profile. Maybe they don't. There was a lot of backlash against the article because people were calling it a witch hunt and everything. I think the main point that I will say when I write about it, and I'm saying now, is that the fact that this stuff is still going on, regardless of what this couple does or whatever, just the reparative therapy and the lies and the damage it causes to people, you know, the fact that it's still going on is dumbfounding and needs to be called out.
Yeah, I mean, I feel for you. I had no idea about your history with the reparative therapy, because that that's obviously been a big target for me. I've never been exposed to it personally. I've never been involved in it personally, but, you know, done lots of research, talked to lots of people who have been in it. You know, I've certainly rubbed my elbows with it plenty. Before we move on to that, though, just one point about the Gaineses and everything else. I think some people are feeling that it's sort of like Obama and the minister he had in Chicago, where, you know, how much can you, you know, pin on a person? Although, you know, to your point, you know, when you're there, you're either toying the line or pretending to, which is, you know, that it's a considerable personal investment. So, you know, there is that.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, the other point about that, I mean, I certainly read that comparison as well. Number one, this church, it's not typical. I mean, I know a lot of people grow up in the church, whether they're Catholic or Protestant or Jewish or whatever, and it's kind of part of the culture. You go to church, you have your weddings there, your funerals, whatever, and you can kind of go home and do your own thing. This church is a very dynamic church. It's very much about, I mean, that's, you know, you're in it. I mean, you can be on the peripheral, but it's hard because that's like the whole vibe of the church is it's very like evangelical, you know, missionaries, outreach, you know, all that kind of thing. But the other point I want to make is that Obama did eventually distance himself from the minister and then actually resigned from the church because the minister was saying some things that he couldn't abide with. So there's that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So getting into the reparative therapy? I know a lot of the people I've been involved with and talked to about it, there are a percentage of those people who voluntarily walked into that because of, I mean, they were certainly predispositioned to want to try it. And in all honesty, at a certain point in my life, I probably would have been one of them, even if that had that been made available to me. Was it something you were forced into or something you raised your hand for?
I sought it out. I mean, but I was, and I think that, I mean, I know that a lot of the legislation that's been passed against it is directed at not allowing it to be used or whatever on minors.
Right.
But I think, you know, for me, growing up in a minister's home and growing up predominantly in the South, I didn't know any gay people. There was no, this is also, you know, late 80s. There was no options for me. There was like, oh, I mean, this is what you do when you have a problem is you look to God or you look to the church.
Right, right.
But I, you know, my freshman year of college, I called the health center and said, that was the first time I'd ever spoken out loud. I think that I'm gay. What do I do? Do you have counselors? Do you have shock treatment? I think I should have said that. Because I had heard about that.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God.
I was that desperate. But the fact that I said it out loud, I mean, I remember, you know, I was like shaking. And I was 18. So I wasn't a minor, but I still, you know, I was very young and for a while I had that thought that like, oh, well, you know, I put myself through this. Nobody forced me to, but I think in retrospect now being in my late-ish 40s that, I was between 18 and 23. And the people that I look to and the people that counseled me and mentored me, I mean, I do consider anybody that age to be a victim. I would now, once I look back at myself and say, you know,
and I, just to be clear, I see you having been victimized by it as well. Even before that though, because I mean, I relate so much to everything you're just saying, in my case, I didn't go anywhere about it. I basically went right to God, and I was around the same age. And for me, I actually prayed and said, okay, God, this is not going away. and it's not my plan to be this. And you are going to take this away now, or I'm going to kill myself. I mean, that's what I laid out to God directly. And there have been two times in my life when I actually heard a voice of God back from a prayer, and that was one of them. And it was this burst of anger of, how dare you? And it was shocking. And I will never forget that experience. But my point on that is that I think the lead into that reparative therapy for people who walk through the door of their own or seemingly of their own volition, we've been programmed for years to do that. It was not, it's not a spur of the moment decision. I mean, for an 18-year-old to get on the phone and ask for shock therapy, I mean, that's not something you just kind of fell out of bed and thought you might do that.
Right. Right. Yeah. I believe I had read, I think the summer before college, I had read an article about, it was in a magazine called Campus Life. You may have heard of it, but it was a teen college magazine, a Christian magazine. And it had an article, an interview with somebody about who had gone through paratherapy or an ex-gay group or something, and how they'd been healed or whatever. And so that's kind of where I first got the idea, I think. Because it wasn't anything my dad ever preached about. My dad has never preached an anti-gay sermon ever. So.
Yeah. No. And it's it's, I don't even think it's just that line of, in fact, for me with my parents, I was so afraid of them finding out. I mean, they were like the last hurrah it was even to the point when I had dates with men that came over to my place, I would hide my parents' pictures, my family's pictures, when I had somebody come in. I was in LA, my parents were in Orange County, which is an hour and a half away in a major metropolis. And it wasn't like one of my dates was suddenly going to run into my parents and go, oh, by the way, I dated your son. The paranoia was just that intense around it. So, but I guess what I'm saying is, though, I think even whatever our parents' attitudes are, the feedback we get from the whole social circle in general, I mean, it's, it makes us want to hide from our parents more because we're going to let them down, that type thing. So for you, who you were then, what, and who you are now in terms of this stellar example of a gay dad and, creating a family and, all sorts of really wonderful values in anybody's book. What at that point did you think when you were 18 that being gay was about?
Well, I mean, it was about, having anonymous sex in dark alleys and getting AIDS and dying alone. that's all I knew of it.
And you didn't want that. Why?
Right. I think it was not only foreign, it was unknown and isolating and scary. And, I don't think I went so far as to imagine what my life would be like. It was just knowing I can't be that nebulous, that whatever that was.
So have you stopped now to evaluate what you've done as a blogger, putting out stories and stories about your life as a gay man, your relationship, your having a son, the love around you, and what you have done to put that picture out into the minds of current young people who are gay so that they no longer think of being gay as dark alleys, anonymous sex, and hate?
Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, I'll get, you know, a really nice email or message from somebody. And I have readers who are in the process of getting married or trying to adopt or, and that's always fun and amazing when they'll give me their progress about how it's going, or they'll say, oh, we just got married, and, you know, people that I've been interacting with for quite a few months, and that's always amazing. But when the whole not to spend too much time on it, but with the whole Gaines's thing, and I had posted something about it on Facebook, the initial article, and kind of said, oh, I may need to respond to this, and mentioned that this was the same pastor that I had.
Right.
I got at least 3 or 4 friend requests from people who had gone to that church. Some I knew, some I didn't. Just wanting to connect, and, you know, who had kind of gotten out of the situation, and some who were gay and some who weren't, some were just straight. And there was even a girl who I had been good friends with her parents, and I knew her when she was a kid in high school. And she said, call me. And apparently her 13-year-old daughter had just come out to her. But her parents were still heavily involved in this church. And she was like, I don't know what to do. Should I tell my parents? And so we had a good conversation about that, about what she could do and what her daughter could do. And I gave her some resources of things for parents of gay kids. And so, I mean, that was, you know, thank God for Facebook in those situations. So it's amazing the things that I publish or that I am involved in that help, you know, the randomness of people. So it's always a good motivator to keep doing it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, the reason I asked that of you, you know, to kind of evaluate what an impact you likely have had, is because I know firsthand about my own experience with it. And it's something that, you know, it's why I do what I do too. But when my boys were babies, I was on a site called BeliefNet. And BeliefNet had this forum. This was well before Facebook, but it was beginnings of social media. And they had these discussion forums where literally people were going on from various religious belief angles and debating, you know, being gay and whether it was right to be gay, wrong to be gay, whatever. And I actually forged a lot of virtual relationships with people on there because we would all get on and we would debate and, you know, do the early version of blogging and everything else. One friend of mine on there was a young man who went through horrific reparative therapy issues and being forced into it and, you know, just horror stories on horror stories. And at one point I remember, you know, talking about having gone out to dinner with my partner and my two baby boys and just talking about how the reactions of the people around me. And he wrote back and he said, I cannot tell you how important I think that is, that you do that. If I can't even tell you the impact it would have had on me, you know, as a young man going out and seeing a gay family live. And it was just like, it just made me really aware that what you do, Brent, and what I do has far bigger ripples than we're probably aware of, you know, beyond the people who say something directly to us. But, you know, I know one time I was friended by somebody from, he was a professor. He's actually still probably on my friends list. He's a professor in Pakistan. And I was like, well, that's pretty interesting, you know, friending somebody in Pakistan. And he sent me a note about how he was debating whether you know, gay men were capable of being fathers. And, you know, all the people around him were like saying, oh, that's ridiculous. That's, you know, can't happen, you know, blah, 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 all the cliches and misconceptions and all that stuff. And he said what he turned to them and said, of course it can happen. There's Rob Watson. And it was like, whoa, you know, there's Brent Allman, there's Rob Watson there. You know, it's like we're the punchline of arguments around the world of what gay men actually are.
Well, you know, it's I think sometimes it's easy too to get, you know, I think we saw this with the election and not just with gay dads, but I mean, that's our experience. So that's what we look to, but, you know, get kind of lulled into the idea that it's becoming more normal, and it is. I mean, there's more and more of us, and I have tons of gay dad friends here in the Washington, D.C. area. But it's still, you know, my son is still the only one in his class with two dads, and that's something that he has to deal with. But the, you know, I think a neat experience that I had in October was I spoke at the National At-Home Dad Network conference. They have a conference every year. It's like an at-home dad conference. It's not blogging. It's more just kind of networking for at-home dads.
Right.
And they had asked me to speak, to moderate this panel on LGBT dads, or LGBT parenting. And the reason they had initiated this panel was because the conference was in Raleigh, North Carolina, and a lot of people were upset about it being there because of Household 2 and not wanting to give money to the economy, but it had already been bought and paid for the year before, so they couldn't really get out of the money they'd already spent, so they wanted to do something to kind of counter that. And so
this was after the bathroom bill stuff went down.
Right. It hadn't been voted on yet, but it was still very much, going on. And it was actually a trans dad who was on the panel who I got to be friends with. And he would joke like, I'm going to the bathroom now, you know, come get, you know, hopefully I won't get arrested. But that was an amazing experience. Cause you know, we talked to a room of dads from all over the country, and I think more so than a blogging conference, there was a wider array of political leanings. It was probably one of the largest panels of the conference. And what we found and the way we were able to relate to these guys is that they're stay-at-home dads, and they're often in situations where they feel like they're the outsider, that there's nothing for them, it's just for the moms, or they'll be at a park and be looked at like a predator, or all the things that they deal with. And that's how we were able to relate to them and find common ground. And we got so much great feedback from it. It was a really kind of surprisingly awesome experience to be able to connect with so many fathers.
Yeah, no, that is me. And you know, I'm one of the executive editors of the Goodman Project, and prior to becoming one of the executive editors, I was the lead editor for the Dads and Families section.
Right.
And I kind of still am, because there's nobody really that we had somebody there, but I still watch out for that section. And the interaction with dads across the spectrum is pretty incredible. I mean, it's and not all that different in a lot of the issues. There are so many straight dads that I completely relate to, because we kind of really do have the same issues. And mm-hmm. and it's more men who are parents who are completely and with every fiber of their being committed to being the best parent they can be. And there are certainly men out there who have physically fathered children that don't fall into that category. But the men who do, gay, straight, bi, you know, it's you know, it becomes all about the kids ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's always something that I relate to. And I mean, that's kind of also in the gay dads Facebook group, which is a public group, or gay fathers, whatever it is. And not to put down anything they do, but I find that I have had so much richer and deeper and meaningful relationships and interactions with the guys in the dad bloggers Facebook group.
Right.
And with the vast majority of them are,
you know, here's one thing I find really kind of interesting about those two groups, because I'm in both of them as well. Of the two groups, one group talks about penises a lot.
Yeah.
And the other group talks about them almost never, ever.
Yes.
And the one that talks about them a lot is the presumably straight dad's group.
Yes. Yes, I tease them about that all the time. I think part of it is the gay father's group is also, it's a public group. And I think because we're all gay dads, there's a heightened sense of, we don't want there to be any hinted of propriety here, because we're being looked at more closely.
Right.
So we're not going to be on
that. Before you move up that point, because that's an incredible point, how do you feel in your life in general under that kind of microscope that you are not allowed to screw up at all? Because you are an example of a gay dad, and if you screw up, it won't be a screw up or Brent was being human, or, you know, all dads don't know what to do all the time, but gay dads can't parent.
I don't know that I ever. Usually most of that is self-imposed.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think once you get into the throes of it, you kind of don't. I don't think very often about the fact that I'm a gay dad or that I'm an adopted dad, because I'm like trying to keep my kid from running through the parking lot or, you know,
yeah,
whatever it is. There are times when I feel a little bit like an outsider. But it's usually not when I'm interacting with my kid. It's usually when I'm standing around or observing, or it's more of a parent thing. But usually I'm, you know, I've got other things to worry about.
Right. What is the, just being a dad? Because one thing I found is that, you know, it really, I've had almost no negatives, at least in my life. You know, I have online, but in my life, I haven't had any negatives about being a gay dad. But I have had plenty of situations where I had to assert myself as a parent and being male. In other words, that because I wasn't female, I became invalidated in my parenting by other people. I don't know if that's happened to you, but if it has, what has been the most surprising thing to you in terms of minimization because you're a dad?
Well, I think most of the time it's been it's been done from a standpoint of not intentionally being malicious or dismissive. It's just people assuming that every family is heteronormative, you know?
Right.
And it's kind of I just kind of assume I'm going to be educating people off and on for forever. I got pretty early on, I was like, you know, I've got to do this job and I can't worry about what people think. And it's been liberating in a way to kind of put myself out there and, okay, I'm a dad, I'm an adopted dad, and I'm a gay dad. And I've got a lot of important things to do, so I can't worry about what other people think. I've just got to go for it.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Now you do some pretty unique things with your son that, you know, your own way of showing him how much you love him and being creative, and you've written about those. Can you go into some of those that you've done in his short life already?
Well, there's definitely the lunch notes, which I guess we'll talk about Christmas Eve.
We'll go into detail on that, but if you can go into a little bit now, that would be
sure,
cool.
Sure.
Too.
Well, I mean, you know, like I mentioned, being able to like relive my childhood through my son, which I think a lot of dads do. But that's been so much fun to like introduce him to all the, you know, superheroes and Star Wars and comic book characters and all that stuff that I grew up on and loved, and now he's getting to experience. And there's new versions of him, like getting to take him to the new Star Wars movie was amazing.
Right.
And that's how the notes came about. Like his first day of preschool, I put a little note in his lunch with a picture of Batman on it and said, you know, go get him or whatever it was. And he loved it. And I did it that first week. And then he started doing it. He liked it, and his friends and teachers started talking about it. And, he was like giving them away sometimes. And, so it just became a fun thing that I do. And granted, sometimes it's not that fun, but I still do it. I've even, if I didn't get it done in time before he left, I've been known to take it to school once or twice, but there is one, you know, I'm trying to get out of that because I'm like, he's got to learn. If he doesn't get ready in time, he doesn't get a note.
Right.
But I still, you know, I'm not going to stop, you know, unless he specifically says I don't want him anymore. But, that's like the main thing. But, you know, he loves to draw, he loves to sing and dance, and so that's always fun. But he also, you know, loves martial arts and wrestling and stuff that I don't know anything about. So, I mean, that's a challenge for me to get out of my own bubble and find creative ways to be involved in his life like that.
Well, actually, what you just touched on was one of my biggest concerns becoming a dad with boys was, you know, because all the negative stuff online and, you know, everything else was, you know, oh, my gosh, you know, it's like a boy needs a mom or a girl needs a mom because, you know, you don't know how to do the mom stuff and you're depriving him of a mom and blah, 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 all this stuff. And it's like, I'm going, I've got the mom stuff.
Yeah.
I've got it down. I know.
Except for breastfeeding, we're good.
What I'm worried about is I don't know the baseball stuff. I don't know the football stuff. I don't know all the, you know, it's like, you know, I literally was really sweating over the straight dad stuff. You know, which of course was never part of the conversation, but yeah, you know, I'm also laughing just because I related to what you were saying about Star Wars and sharing that with your kid and everything else. And I think I became hyper aware of the difference between yours and my ages because I'm guessing I'm probably about 10 years older than you. Because Star Wars came out for me and it was a college age experience rather than my youth. So anyway,
yeah.
I digress. So, how old's your son right now?
He turned 7.
Okay. So mine are 14. And, you know, is there anything that you're worried about in the next few years moving forward? I'm offering you free advice here from my lofty, knowledgeable perch of the dad of teenagers now.
Well, in terms of him, well, let me back up. In terms of our specific family, I do worry about our family's relationship to his birth parents going forward, and him getting more of an understanding of what they're like and why they had to make an adoption plan and
right.
and how that'll affect him. That because right now he really seems to be able to focus on the fact that he has the two best daddies in the world and that his birth parents picked us. And but I know at some point the other shoe's going to drop and he's going to have to deal with feelings of rejection. And that I worry about for him.
Well, I will share this with you because I shared that concern because I've got two boys, you know, very different birth parent stories. We have different relationships with the birth families. And I was worried about that because at one point it, you know, around your son's age with both of them, it became subjects. I mean, that they needed to talk about and we needed to talk about and, you know, we need to hash through. And I have to tell you, while I anticipated that as that went on, that was going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, it's been the opposite. It's been the absolute mm-hmm. opposite. It's like right now I'm the one walking around to them going, you know, do you want to talk about it? Do you want to meet them? Do it? No, not interested. They're just people out there. It's just, you know, it's, and I don't know what the trigger is, and I don't know, it may be unique to us, you know, and you may have a different experience, but it was one of the big surprises for me that it wasn't more. And with my boys, the, you know, my now ex-partner and I went through a divorce. We never got legally married, but we got legally divorced, which is another, you know, little, you know, weirdy thing. But my sons react to it the same way any other kids would. You know, it's like they're so tied to both of us as parents and kids. And, you know, it's like there are no others. I mean, there literally just are no others. And so anyway, I share that with you as just, you know, I think it might surprise you how little an issue that actually becomes.
Well, I hope so. I mean, that's kind of when we were going through the process and when we adopted him, the, you know, open adoptions were really becoming the norm. And so that's what we have. And he knows them and he has a biological brother that he knows as well. But, you know, more, yeah. It's a balance of trying not to project, but also make sure he knows that we're there and make sure that he knows everything he needs to know.
Right. Right. No, it was, for me, it was a point with my oldest son where I had pictures of his birth parents and it was like, they were literally in my hands. It's like, do you want to look at them? And it's like, no, not really. And it's like, please look at them. It's like, yeah. I mean, it was like that. That literally was the conversation. But yeah. So Brent, tell us more where people can find you, what you're working on now. This is your space for blatant self-promotion.
Well, I blog at designerdaddy.com and that's my handle pretty much everywhere else on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. I'm also on, my lunch notes are on Instagram at Super Lunch Notes. And I pop up here and there other places too. I'm going to be doing another, moderating another Gay Dads panel at Dad 2.0 in San Diego in February. We're still working on the details of that and how to make it distinct to that audience, but I'm excited to be doing that.
Well, if you need any help on that, you know, I can make it to San Diego. Just
FYI. Oh, good. Yeah, definitely.
But, yeah, no, that's fantastic. So what advice, because you, not only are you a great dad and all that, but you bring this, you know, your creativity to it. For all parents, what are some creative ideas that they could adopt that would be fun and doable for your everyday, only semi-talented parent?
Oh, gosh. I mean, the thing is, you know, I think people normally typically think of creativity as being something artistic or visual. But I mean, it's, there's so many different ways to creative, to parent creatively, whether it's, you know, the whole thing of making something into a game in order to get your kids to participate or to enjoy it, whether it's dinner or getting ready for bed or, you know, brush their teeth or anything like that. I constantly have to retrain myself and make sure that I do that as opposed to, you know, hollering or getting upset. But the, you know, that's a big part of the creativity for me as well. It's just, you know, getting ready for, like getting ready for school, for example. Instead of having to stand there and watch them get ready the whole time, I'll say, I'm going to go to my office. And whenever you get one piece of clothing on, I want you to go out to the hall and do one of your Taekwondo moves and to give me a good aya, because that's all you would do anyway. So just trying to find what he enjoys and kind of integrate that into things that he might not want to do otherwise.
Right. No, that's very cool. Yeah. It's actually, I adopted one or something similar to what you were saying before, in that early on, I decided I was not, and I pretty much have lived up to this, but I was not going to be one of those yelling, screaming parents, you know, especially in public. But even at home, it's just not who I wanted to ever be. And certainly there are times when your kids push you to that level of frustration where you just want to let loose. And to your point, I took the creative approach, and what I did was I said, you know, can you come over here? And I'd keep that up until they were right in front of me, and then I'd whisper. And it was by design, because for whatever reason, those whispers absolutely terrified them. Me whispering at them made them quake in their boots. And I got to pat myself on the back that I wasn't one of those screaming banshee parents that it always lose their effect. So it was, I think your point on creativity with how you parent and discipline is super, super valuable. So we're down to our last 6 minutes, believe it or not. So usually people are amazed at this point how fast it all went.
I can see the little clock on online. So.
You've been watching the minutes. Okay. So what would you say to dad bloggers in the age of Trump? We have 4 more years of this nonsense. How are we going to survive?
Well, you know, I was just having survive as fathers or survive as bloggers.
either both or, you know, combination of the two.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was just talking to Doug French, who's the head of Dad 2.0, saying, you know, have we ever had a panel or a workshop on anger management, especially as it relates to kind of bringing work home, especially those of us that write about things from an advocacy or an opinion standpoint. And I find that if I, you know, I can get really pissed off reading something online about Trump or whoever. And if I don't watch it, that can carry over to how I interact with my kid, whether I have less patience or, you know, just tense. So I don't know what advice I would give other than just, you know, keep talking to each other and networking and finding, you know, taking it out on each other if we need to, and not on our kids, and learning how to unplug when we need to. If it means we don't blog as much, that's a small price to pay.
Right. Got it. So, Brent, in the last few minutes, what haven't I asked you that I should have?
Oh, God, I don't know. I'm working on a children's book. I'm only saying this just to help motivate myself, but it's a writing and illustrating a children's book that will be kind of for kids with same-sex parents, but pretty much for anybody. So I've got an agent and everything, so just want to put that out there. So people will ask me about it.
That's exciting. So I'm glad we ended with that, because I'm going to lead with that on the next interview. So that we talk about that a lot more. So yeah,
ask me how that's going.
Are we confirmed for Christmas Eve?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. So, folks, I wanted to verify that before I said, all right, so if you love this interview, which you should have, you know, we will be on Out in Santa Cruz on Christmas Eve with Brent and talking about a really intense, you know, beautiful project that he's been doing with the Post-it notes and his son's lunchbox and a retrospect of all the best of from that. And that will make for a really wonderful Christmas Eve show. That is, you can listen to it live streaming on KSCO.com or outinsantacruz.com. You can hear it live. And if you're in the Northern California area, it is 1080 AM and 104.1 FM. You can hear that on Christmas Eve. So that'll be a little bit different kind of show, but it will be just as much fun. So, Brent, I really appreciate you being on here with me tonight. And, you know, I can't wait for Christmas Eve.
Yeah. Hopefully all my Santa duties will be done by then. So.
Yeah, exactly. That it'll keep us motivated, or we'll talk fast while we're on the radio. Thinking that makes a difference. So I'm going to take us out with Garrett Miller, my absent co-host's song, Guess What? It's Christmas Time. Thank you, Brent, and we'll talk again on Christmas Eve.
All right, thanks a lot.
Well, you might not think it's Christmas with the sunshine in the trees. You might not even think of Santa Claus with his dogs down by the beach. Oh, their tails, they are a-wagging, wagging here to there. And the joyous sounds of barking without care. They've been clipped with bells and bows. How they love to lick your nose. And old Saint Nicky knew. And guess what? It's Christmas time for you. You might not think it's Christmas without your winter clothes. You might want a tiny puppy or one with a big brown nose. Either way, you'll feel so happy with love from Santa's sleigh. And playing with your puppy